there is a musicality at the core of our emotional or affective life. And that really does go back to early mother-infant communications, or the kind of innate musicality, or what Trevathan calls communicative musicality, the to and fro of the dynamic between mother and baby, is really the core, the scaffolding of our emotional life.
Welcome to the IPA podcast. For those of you who have been listeners to the past 40 episodes of this podcast series, you know that we've been focusing on analysts who bring their clinical skills to venues outside of the consulting room, hence the name psychoanalysis on and off the couch. Given that we are all facing together a crisis of unfathomable proportions, we're going to be changing the focus of our podcast. We are going to be interviewing psychoanalysts from all corners of the globe to discuss with them how their local communities are coping with this situation, how their clinical work has been affected by this situation, and also how the internal worlds of both the analyst and the patient have been impacted by this virus, as it impacts both our real fears and our imaginary fears. We're going to encounter not only uncertainty and fear, but we're also going to learn great wisdom, gifted empathy, and hope. We'll be maintaining the title of this podcast, both as a testament to our past work and as a placeholder for our future work. I hope you find these conversations both informative and sustaining. Feel free to write comments on our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org. Thank you. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Harvey Schwartz, and my guest today is Dr. Roger Kennedy. Dr. Kennedy is a training and supervising analyst and past president of the British Psychoanalytical Society. He's also a child and adolescent psychiatrist, and he is now the medical director of the Child and Family Practice in London, a private multidisciplinary clinic where he and the staff work with children, families, and parents, specializing in children with complex needs. Roger has written 13 previous books. Our focus today is on his latest, which is called The Power of Music, Psychoanalytic Explorations, published by Phoenix Press. But his history of writing is really remarkable in its breadth. He's written on psychoanalysis and history. He's written on tolerating strangers in intolerant times. He's written short stories based on his work with Anna Lassands. He's written on psychotherapists as expert witnesses and working with people with histories of child abuse. He's really, truly a Renaissance man. In our conversation today, we discuss the similarities and differences of listening to music and listening to analytic material, how the immersion for analyst, for musician, for listener, for analyst and has certain things in common, a certain depth of attention, a certain resonance. And he provides a clinical example where enabling a patient to hear the way they sound to be a vital part of her growing awareness, and with that, a freedom to sound different ways and to tune into more authentic aspects of herself. And speaking about authenticity, towards the end, when I ask Roger about his background, he shares his personal story of attending to music, involving to music through sharing it with his father. He describes at the age of 4, listening to Sibelius with his father, and that being a key part of his long development as a music lover, as well as a listener of people. I hope you enjoy it as I have. It really is an opportunity to get to know a scholar in our field, a gifted listener, and a man who has available to him, just as we hope for ourselves and our patients, a breadth of affects with which he shares and we can enjoy. This is my conversation with Dr. Roger Kennedy. Roger, welcome to the podcast. It's so nice to have you with us.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Roger, the best way I can introduce this subject that we're going to spend time today on, the interface between psychoanalytic listening and music listening, is by bringing forward a quote from your book. Your book, to repeat, is called The Power of Music, Psychoanalytic Explorations. And this is a quote actually not written by you, but by someone you quote. And it says, quote, "Listening is about more than just hearing. It is about engaging, empowering, inspiring, and creating bonds. True listening is a holistic act." Close quote. Now, that lovely phrase could certainly have been written by an analyst describing an important facet of what it means to listen psychoanalytically. But in fact, it wasn't. It was written by a Scottish deaf percussionist by the name of Evelyn Glennie. And that quote about the nature of listening and the wholeness of the listening experience is really the leitmotif of your book, where you describe, in from many points of view, from the neuroscience points of view, from the developmental point of view, from the clinical point of view, that fine line that both connects and separates psychoanalytic listening and musical listening. Just to mention three examples that caught my eye in reading your book. You talk about the musical hold, that there are vocal rhythms that form part of the bonds between people. You have many phrases for it. You call it communicative musicality, or you call it the vocal rhythms of interpersonal engagement. These are phrases that represent both the mother's rhythm with her newborn, often in utero as well, and it also describes the musicality of psychoanalytic rhythms between analyst and analysand. You mention the reverie of musical listening. You call it deep listening or time-free hearing, where the listener really immerses him or herself in the experience of listening, where you can hear both superficial manifest themes and also the underlying, the latent themes, and how common that is in what we call free-floating attention as a psychoanalyst. And finally, my favorite phrase that you use is frisson, which I've come to learn means a thrill, a heightened excitement, which is certainly something people who love music know. It's literally called a goosebump phenomena. And that you analogize that to analytic listening, where there are surprises, surprises for the analyst and surprises for the analysand. Elaborate, if you will. Share with us what your sense is over the years of how, as you've immersed yourself both in the musical world and your psychoanalytic work, how each has informed the other.
Yes, well, you've kind of put together a number of interesting quotes, which really capture what I've been trying to talk about in this area of music. I'm trying to look in general at the power of music and make sense of it, because it does affect us at so many levels. But one of them, the main points, is that there is a musicality at the core of our emotional or affective life. And that really does go back to early mother-infant communications, or the kind of innate musicality, or what Trevathan calls communicative musicality, the to and fro of the dynamic between mother and baby as really the core, the scaffolding of our emotional life. So that's on the one hand something about the deep emotionality, which is has this musical element. I mean, you see it when mothers and babies mm-hmm. talk to one another, you know, cooing and upping and down, and all that's nice. And you see the ups and downs. Daniel Stern talks about the vitality affects with the shape of the emotional the emotionality between mother and baby. That on the one hand, when it comes to psycholytic listening, obviously, it's not like listening to a concert or to a might be more like listening to song or an opera sometimes, or tragedy. But it's obviously different from actual musical listening, but there's a lot in parallel, a lot in common. And I think there's something essentially musical in how we listen, and certainly it requires a certain amount of musicality to hear the to and fro of the discourse and the underlying emotionality. So that's how I see how musical and analytic listening come together. And this is also commented by other analysts in the past.
Do you think one way to characterize the difference is in listening to music, it is an entirely narcissistic experience for the listener. We are attending to the pleasures and energies and imaginations stimulated in us. And while that's part of free-floating attention on the part of an analyst, we are always focused fundamentally on how we use that experience to understand another, which is why it's called work. I mean, it isn't just gratuitous listening.
Yes, but that's only partly true, because musical listening for the musician is not. It's intersubjective. Or if you talk to conductors, and Mark Wigglesworth, who's a well-known conductor here, who's been very interested in the book, and in fact, we want to do a joint activity or joint thing about listening, because there's so much in common. If you're a conductor, you have to listen to the orchestra. You have to have a to and fro, what I would call a listening dynamic. If you're a string quartet, each of the players are deeply entrained with one another, looking and listening to each other. So that kind of musical listening can't be narcissistic. If you're a singer singing arias on your own, you can be a narcissist. But if you're in a performance, you have to link up to your performance, to the chorus, to the concert, to the orchestra. And in that sense, no, I wouldn't see it in that way.
I've revealed myself as not a performer, but just a listener for pleasure.
But also, I suppose when you listen, I mean, I listen. You pick up the audience. You pick up the mood. It's not only, I mean, if you're listening, of course, with your earphones, especially during lockdown here, you know, on your own, you're listening to, or in the car, what I quite like to do. That is a kind of self-absorbed kind of listening. You're not listening to the other as such. But if you're in an audience, if you're with your friends, with your partners, in a way, part of the enjoyment is the sharing of the listening experience and the appreciation. And you talk about it afterwards and what you think about this and that. It's very difficult to maintain that simple, isolated position, I think.
And each has helped you in your respective listenings, or not helped, but enriched?
I would say so. Over the years, I've become more interested in the actual process of listening, which after all is basic to psychoanalysis. The whole point about Freud, he listened to his patients, listened to the bits and pieces and fragments, the dreams, all the things that psychologists, psychiatrists were not interested in, thought was irrelevant. So it's opening his ears, as it were, to hear things that other people hadn't heard. Think of Evelyn Glennie. It's not just about simply hearing information. It's much more about the whole listening experience at different levels. I mean, Freud opened up that whole area. And so it is basic to psychoanalysis. But there hasn't been so much attention to that side. There's a lot of attention to interpretation, defenses, anxieties. But as over the years, I've become much more interested in just simply the quality of listening and also the quality of the patient's voice and how they speak and how their voice may be strangulated, they can't speak, they can't say things, they can't listen to themselves, helping the patient listen internally to themselves. I've become much more interested in that. And when I do supervisions or run clinical seminars, you know, more and more in recent years, people have tended to bring their typed out notes. I just can't do that. I said, well, you can have them if you like, but I'm not interested. I just want to hear what what you say about the patient, what the patient has to say. And that way you can hear the rhythms, you can hear the between the lines, the silences. And I can't, if I'm looking and trying to read, I feel I lose those essential underlying ups and downs of the tones and of the underlying quality. If it's a foreign language I don't understand, if I have to occasionally have to do a seminar in Russian or something, obviously I need to read it for the translation. But you do miss the nuance of the music, of the language.
You mentioned Freud, it's often been emphasized that the use of the couch it takes away what people associate to the biblical phrase of the graven image, not to see the other, but to let one's mind go and discover new places. But it's often not emphasized that puts a premium on the listening. And he was famously tone deaf and didn't have interest in musicality in the usual sense. But in this sense, obviously, he was deeply interested in the hearing process.
Well, of course, yes. I mean, I think it's been, I think he probably overstated the fact that he was tone deaf. I understand he did like some kinds of music, mainly Austrian popular type music. But it is a sound world, a soundscape. And Didier Anzieux talked about the early sound envelope in the mother-baby relationship is important. It isn't a visual, essentially, it isn't a visual world, the pure analytic work. It is this intense soundscape, which is very different. I think it brings people together, the sounds bring people together. Often the visual can keep them separate. It's about separateness. Mm. And so I think the very fact that we don't literally observe the eyes of the other, except when we're doing therapy and supportive work. I see children, and obviously it's a bit different, but in ordinary and psychoanalytic work, it's another level. At the moment, I'm, because of lockdown and COVID, with my analytic patient, like many of my colleagues here in the UK, I am not seeing people face-to-face in my consulting room. I'm seeing a few people in my clinic, families, but that's in a different environment, different bigger room with ventilation and so on and masks. But I am talking to them on the phone. And some people are doing it on Zoom, but not looking. There are different ways of doing it. But I'm finding, of course, you do miss the presence of the other. But I'm having to listen even more carefully. And other things are coming out. And the patients have said this. By and large, they've said at first, it was strange. They've said, you're talking too much, Dr. Kennedy. You're talking too much. And I think I was desperately trying to connect up. And not listening enough and talking too much. And then gradually you could get back into the slow listening experience.
Do you ordinarily listen when you're in the office with a patient? Do you close your eyes?
I often do, yes. I often do. Naturally, it's like that, yes. There are other times when I'm looking outside, I've got a rather nice view of some trees outside my consulting room, so it's rather pleasant. So sometimes my mind may wander, or I may have associations, or I just want to rest. But when there's something very intense going on, I'm wanting to know, what's going on here? What's my response? Yes, you're right. I do find myself closing my eyes.
Would you say that your listening style has changed in a particular way over the years?
Yes, I think so. I mean, I've been doing it for about 40 years, so it's inevitable there's going to be changes. I speak less. I still make interpretations and transference interpretations, but I'm not anxiously thinking, oh my God, I've got to make a transference interpretation or not doing the work. I'm more relaxed, I hope, generally, and hopefully more spontaneous and allowing more of my own human responses to come in. Whereas when I was younger, I was much more frightened, I think. Am I doing the right thing? So all the superego was there. And I think all that stuff comes in the way of simply listening to the patient and responding. So I think, I'd like to think the gestures, as it were, inverted commas, are sparer and more effective than they used to be. Yeah, I think so.
Your emphasis is on classical music in what you write, and yet what you're just describing was a form of improvisation. Is that of interest to you?
Yes. I mean, because my knowledge is essentially Western classical tradition, or in the book, I do talk about a little bit about jazz and popular music and also culture and different cultures. For example, the Busavi tribe in Papua New Guinea, where there's been a lot of research about the role of music in their whole culture. I mean, music for them isn't just simply as it is for us. It involves a whole lot of other experiences. But my own knowledge is basically that. Although I do like, personally, popular music, and I like dancing to it, in fact. I can't listen to it for too long, but I don't.
I understand both elements, the enjoying the dancing ability of it and not being able to listen to it for too long.
Jazz, I do like jazz, I have to say.
Sure.
I have my jazz moments.
Yes.
I remember going to New York Jazz Club years ago when I was an analytic student at one of the New York conferences, and loving the going to a New York jazz club. It was just so different from London, you know, so alive.
And we all look forward to returning to that period of life. Yeah. Can you give us a clinical example of to allow it to come alive, to how musical listening informs your clinical moments?
Yes, well, you did ask me, and I was thinking about this. Obviously, I've distorted clinical
example
for obvious reasons, but I hope it encapsulates one aspect of what I'm talking about. It's about a female patient with difficulties in being in touch with her emotions, middle-aged woman, and she has a rather typical background over here, being sent to an English boarding school at a young age. That trauma of abandonment cut out memories of early relationships, which were anyway probably rather anxiety-ridden, with generations of family attending boarding school, again, not uncommon in a certain English class structure. So with me, the sessions remained somewhat stilted and uncomfortable, and she had great anxiety about feeling dependent, the terror of letting go and freely associating. She would often be rigid on the couch, fearful of having her own voice. Her voice was indeed often flat, lacking expression. So there was a lack of modulation of feeling. And I was really over and over experiencing her hopelessness without knowing how to help her change. And I was aware of a lack of reverie, of kind of close entrainment between her and me. And that made me feel very uncomfortable. And what do I do about this? However, there was a moment after a couple of years when things showed a possibility for change. Her mother became seriously ill in hospital and for the first time showed my patient her vulnerability. And she described in one session pressing her hand, the patient's mother pressing her hand and asking her to stay. And this was a mother that had always been proud of her stiff upper lip attitude to life. This shift really shocked her, my patient. Her voice changed in the session and also became what I would call tragic in its intonation rather than flat. I thought it was tragic as there seemed, as she put it, little time to repair their relationship. I mean, she was seriously ill, her mother. So much time had been wasted. Now, it was at that point that rather than anything, I focused on the change of her voice and what it represented. And if I hadn't, I was afraid that her emotional life would just simply return to its customary lack of expressiveness, coldness and flatness. And in fact, this really did help her bit by bit. And I pointed out, look, your voice, its quality has changed. And she gradually became more alive emotionally. I felt that, you see, interpretations about aggression and wish to keep me at arm's length and so on, would simply have frozen her. I would have mirrored her mother's own lack of mirroring, if you like, or a lack of a responsive sound mirror. And that really shifted things. She became much more emotional and felt a lot more alive. It took a lot of time, obviously, and I've left out a lot of the day-by-day work, but that encapsulates what happened.
You invited her to become aware of the way her voice sounded and what it represented and what it hid.
Yes, exactly. And it was quite a shock to feed that back to her, because you hadn't been used to that mirroring in her relationships, not only her marriage, but also with her mother. Her father was a lot distant figure.
What you're describing sounds very familiar in the language here in the States of defense analysis, that this is her character armor, if you will, that you are engaging her to be curious about with you.
Yes, I agree. And I think my approach to our independent cyclotic tradition owes a lot to the classical tradition and ego and defenses and drive and so on. I certainly have that in my armory. I'm not somebody who's all in the here and now, interpretation of aggression only. I'm certainly very, I think that approach, ego approach, ego psychology approach, and myself have a lot in common. I also go elsewhere, but I agree with you. Yeah.
Roger, you have so many interests. You've written so many books. You've studied and really become masters of many areas, from your legal work, from your testifying, from your child and family work. Tell us about music and you.
Well, yes. Personally, it's been very important. I mean, thinking about my own background, I think you wanted to, you mean my own background and history.
Yeah. What brings you to this interest and at this moment?
Yeah, well, difficult to say exactly, but I mean, I come from a fairly very modest background. My brother and I were the first doctors in the family. You know, small businesses. My father ran a small business in the East End of London, which would be a bit like the Garment District in New York, basically. Mm-hmm. Although it's all gone now, he was relatively uneducated, left school at 14, but was very encouraging of us in our education. He was a very bright man who should have been an academic, I think, very good at languages and very musical. So that's where I come from. There are two important musical experiences. One was actually an aunt, a Russian aunt, because my family there, my grandparents are all immigrants, Jewish immigrants from Poland, Russia, whatever, in the First World War period. And I remember an aunt, or a great aunt actually, Rosa, who put on, when I was a little boy, I must have been about two, two and a half, this record of Russian music. And incredible, powerful, emotive music. It always haunted me. And indeed, when I went to Russia in the early 90s, and then subsequently very occasionally, I felt in some ways that this was familiar. There was something about the Slav Russian feeling. I felt I could kind of dance to or something. There was that. But then more particularly, my father had a massive collection of old 78s, the old disc that you put seven arrows and they go crash. And each time they would seem to break, but they never did. And I was a little tiny boy when I remember seeing this and being amazed at all these discs that kept falling down and playing music. And it's difficult for many younger people to realize in families, it was all radio and sound, very little visual. I mean, my father was the first in the road virtually to have a TV. And I remember when I was literally three, I think, watching the coronation on the tiny TV. And people coming from the road to watch it on his TV. So he was into that. But we listened to the radio. We had Sunday lunches listening to the radio. Yeah. So the sound world was a sound world. At school, we would talk about, did you hear on the radio? You know, not did you see on the TV or on the internet. Yeah. So listening to those records was a very powerful link to my father. Now, he built up this collection during the Second World War. There were mainly, I think, people like Koussevitzky doing Sibelius, Brahms, a lot of American orchestras, because that's what you could get at that time, not German orchestras. Uh-huh. His master's voice. And it was his way of managing his anxiety about the bombs and the Blitz in the East End. And for him, it was a way of he could kind of get some comfort listening to this music. Mm. So, it was a kind of very close link to my father, and So I was listening to Sibelius, which sounds a strange thing for a little boy of 4 or 5 to be doing, but from a...
Not with his father, it doesn't sound strange.
Exactly, no. Exactly. And I just used to love it. And Shostakovich, I remember Shostakovich's Fifth Symphony, you know, the first movement, you know, powerful movement. As a boy, thinking, what is this music? This is amazing, magical. So I learned the piano, but much later, and I wasn't very good at it, frankly, unlike two of my children who are very good. I don't have that facility with my fingers. It's all in my head, I'm afraid. But,
And so you followed that interest and have been a student of music for all the years since, since early on?
Yes, that's right. And when I was a medical student, I went to the opera, obviously in the gods or standing up. I went to Covent Garden standing. You could stand at the back of the stalls. I remember Kiri Takanawa's first appearance. She was an understudy because the singer for the Countess of the Marriage of Figaro couldn't turn up. And Kiri Takanawa appeared and the house went wild. So I was a medical student standing at the back at that time. And also Wagner, the English National Opera, was in the gods listening to that. So I used to go to concerts in London. There's so many concerts, so many abilities even then. I got very engaged, yeah.
Given this long-standing interest, I'm assuming you've treated musicians as patients, and many things come to my mind about that, one of which is the temptation to be curious about the content of their life for your own pleasure and curiosity, as a presence in the work between the two of you, but also what you've learned about what struck me in my brief experience treating musicians is that they can often express powerful musical affects. Exquisite, moving musical affects, but themselves not necessarily have access to them.
I agree.
And I wonder how you have found that clinically.
Yes, I've had a couple of musicians and someone who is a, how can I put it, like a music therapist. Yes, they're surprisingly cut off and split off from their capacities, and they feel don't touch. This is an area that you shouldn't touch, the area of creativity. I've been very cautious about helping them connect up with that. And it's a bit like with writers. It's rather similar. There are some writers who are blocked and are desperate to get to the root of it. And there are others who say, don't touch this. This is my area of creativity. I think one has to be very nuanced and very use tact, to use Ferenczi's old idea. I think you have to use tact. How far you push this and how far you get to the root of their musicality, because it is the root of their emotional life. And it's something I think you have to just go very carefully with. And as you say, not be too curious about, in the sense of I want to know.
Sure.
Tempting as it is.
But one would think that as their internal obstacles to self-awareness and affective aliveness, as the obstacles softened, as one would hope it would in an ongoing treatment, that their musical creativity would also deepen.
Yes. I mean, that kind of thing usually does happen, but it is something one has to be very careful about. Because it can be quite, you know, creativity and destructiveness can be so near each other. Mm. And it can be a very delicate balance. As I said, I think it's easier if someone's very inhibited and they're desperate to be freed up. But there are those for whom it's more subtle and more difficult. I think one needs to be more aware of the need for caution. But yes, when it's worked, it works well, I find.
Yeah, yes. Roger, hearing your stories of sitting and listening to Sibelius with your father and your travels through the musical world as a medical student and beyond, I had a smile on my face as I was listening. There was such delight and joy in that piece of yourself, and I'm appreciative of your freely sharing that. I do want to close with a paragraph you have written that, like my quote from your book To Begin Us, really summarizes so much. But now that you've added the peace between you and your father, it even is richer. So let me read this. It says, quote, "I have suggested that part of the analytic enterprise consists of a particular form of listening and waiting for the emergence of something that is alive in the human subject. If our psychoanalytic work has any future, the message must surely be that our primary concern is with helping our patients find what is alive in themselves in a world that continues to find that difficult to hear and to bear." Close quote. That's, that really brings you and your thinking and your life's work forward for us to appreciate, enjoy, and learn from.
Well, thank you very much. I'd forgotten that quote.
Well, now you can enjoy it as we can enjoy it, as if it's for the first time.
Not too bad. It's not too bad.
Yes. Roger, thank you for spending your time with us. I'm grateful for it. Appreciate
it. Thank you so much, Harvey. I'm very grateful as well to talk with you. It's been great fun. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. If I may, I'd like to ask you to help us publicize our podcast by rating us on iTunes or simply sharing it with a friend. You can also visit our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can both subscribe and also add your comments. I'd also like to acknowledge the lovely rendition of Beethoven's Opus 18th String Quartet by the Allegri String Quartet on the Vivat label.